Back here on Connecticut Today for Thursday, June 4th on WICC. 2 o'clock hour saw us speak with Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor Bill Dunlap. He got into the details surrounding charges facing four officers in connection with the death of George Floyd. We spoke to one of the two co-authors of a brand new book that looks into the alleged suicide of financier Jeffrey Epstein. We gave you a few minutes of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus update. And at the 5 o'clock hour, we talked to Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield about the continued concern over the extremely high coronavirus deaths in the state's nursing homes. Welcome back, a gentleman who we've had on the program here numerous times to kind of put in plain English what's going on in the legal world, constitutional law professor at the Quinnipiac University School of Law, Professor William Dunlap. Bill, Paul here. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm good, Bill. We're hanging in there and getting through this whole coronavirus thing. But now we have this to look at here. Bill, I wanted to have you on, and thank you for the time, to kind of explain to my listeners here what is going on here legally now. Now, of course, all eyes will turn to the legal procedures here. The primary officer here, former officer Chauvin here, Bill, first they charge him with third-degree murder, which I guess Minnesota's only one of three states that has that, and a manslaughter charge. And then the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, former congressman, he ups that to second-degree murder. So walk us through, Bill, if you can, what the thinking is here.
Sure. Well, third-degree murder, which, as you said, is the one he was originally charged with, deals with unintended killings. It requires the prosecution to prove that the defendant, in this case, Officer Chauvin, engaged in an eminently dangerous act, that this demonstrated that he had a depraved mind and no regard for the value of human life. But the key point of that is that the prosecution does not have to prove that he intended to kill. And that one carries 25 years. The public, and particularly the family and the lawyers that they've hired, seem to think this was not enough. They were extremely incensed at the idea that he was not charged with first degree or second degree murder. But I think the reason that he was not charged with that is that both of those require proving intent. And I think that the Attorney General and the prosecutors are all very dubious whether or not they can prove that Chauvin intended to kill here.
But he did up it now to second-degree murder. So is he, Bill, is he taking a risk here? And I think you and I can hearken back, I always do, to say the Trayvon Martin case where Angela Corey, you may remember, she charged George Zimmerman with second-degree murder. A lot of people say, hey, just go for manslaughter. You'll get him in jail. And Zimmerman walked. I know there are different cases here, but is that the kind of thinking? Is this second-degree murder, Bill, a little bit of a stretch here or not?
I think it may very well be a bit of a stretch. And I think it was upped to second degree murder because of the public response to the original decision. I would be a little surprised if they were able to convict of second degree murder because of the intent requirement. But it's probably not that much of a risk because they are still continuing to charge him with third degree murder. And that, it seems to me, without knowing all of the details of the cases in Minnesota, it seems to me that they have a fairly good case for that.
And it seems, Bill, that they're trying to cover all the bases here, maybe to leave as little wiggle room as possible for his defense team?
I think that's absolutely right, because he's not only charged with both second degree and third degree murder, he's also still charged with second degree manslaughter, which deals with culpable negligence and unreasonable risk. And I don't think it will be difficult for the prosecution to persuade a jury of that.
But again, Bill, you touch on something that I was going to lead into here. It's all about persuasion, Bill. And you and I both know, you go back to numerous cases, you know, including the OJ case and these famous cases where, you know, the public, Bill, oh, slam dunk, I could prosecute this one. Everybody knows it. But, you know, Bill, the jury selection, I'm sure whatever counsel he has may, you know, chime in for a change of venue here. I talked to another civil rights attorney, or a civil rights attorney, the other day, and he's been involved in cases like this, and he doesn't think that this is necessarily, Bill, a slam dunk here.
Oh, I think it's far from a slam dunk, particularly the second-degree murder. I mean, many people in the public were irate because he wasn't arrested and charged immediately after the death. But the prosecutors have to move very, very carefully here. If it had turned out, and I'm not suggesting in the least that this is the case, but if it turned out that he had died of a pre-existing heart condition, if he had died because of a drug overdose, something to that effect, it would be extremely embarrassing for the prosecution to have charged the police officers at that particular level.
And another factor here, Bill, you just touched on that as well, the kind of the dueling autopsy reports here. These aren't even slightly off, Bill. These are 180 degrees polar opposite here. I'm sure that's going to be introduced as evidence as well.
Sure. Well, they're consistent in the fact that both of them agree that this was homicide. The disagreement is on exactly what was the immediate medical cause of death. And that's the sort of thing I meant when I said they really need to wait until after the autopsy and other information is in before they start filing specific charges.
You know, Bill, jury selection, and if in fact Officer Chauvin wants a trial, you know, if he just wants to cut a deal and plead to it, but if he chooses to take this to trial, I mean, Bill, you know how this works with you know, the peremptory challenges and trying to find a neutral jury. How do you find 12 people, Bill, who have not heard of this case and don't have an opinion? I mean, my God, how do you do that?
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of a joke that was going around about 20 years ago with knock, knock, who's there? OJ. OJ who? Okay, you can be on the trial.
Yeah.
Or on the jury.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult. But the key to that is that they don't have to find people who don't know who Chauvin is. They don't have to find people who never heard of the killing. They have to find people who may very well have heard of it and know a lot about it, but are willing to put aside everything they know or think they know and base their decision entirely on the evidence and the arguments that they hear at the trial.
Finally, before we take a break here, Bill, a change of venue, can you see an appeal for that?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be a move for a change of venue, but I think it's going to be hard to find a jurisdiction in which there has not been prejudice. I'm sure all over the state of Minnesota, and I doubt they would move it outside the state of Minnesota. So I would think anywhere in the state that they're going to face roughly the same problem, although it's certainly true that tempers are much higher in Minneapolis than they are in other neighborhoods.
Bill Dunlap, the guest, constitutional law professor, Quinnipiac University. Bill, hang on. We'll be right back with you. I want to ask you about the charges now facing the other three officers. Back with more from Bill Dunlap first. Traffic and weather together, 216 on WICC. As we continue here at, 219, exactly, on the mark here, Connecticut Today for a Thursday. We continue with Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor Bill Dunlap. Now, Bill, the other three officers there who, for lack of a better term, did nothing. They stood by while Officer Chauvin had his knee on the neck of George Floyd. What is the charge facing them, and how is that prosecuted, Bill? And what might be there if they choose to go to trial on this? What might be a legal defense for them?
Well, the three are being charged with aiding and abetting the commission of the murder or the manslaughter, depending on how that comes out. They're being charged with aiding and abetting all three. And apparently, the prosecution believes they did something more than just stand by. When you saw the videos, it looked as though they were standing by. But in order to convict them of this, the prosecution is going to have to prove that they intentionally aided, advised, hired, counseled, or conspired with or otherwise procured Chauvin to commit the crime. So all of those ways of committing aiding and abetting involve some kind of conduct as well as an intent.
Interesting. So I could see heavy questioning, Bill, of these officers. If they testify, who knows, they may stay away from the stand. You know how these things work, obviously. But I guess their actions, as you say, lack thereof, are going to be the central case here. Why didn't you do anything? Did you know there was something going on? They may claim, well, we couldn't see his face from our position. So, you know, I could see again, Bill, where the hair splitting may come in here.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's exactly the sort of defense that they're going to make, that there is no evidence whatsoever that they intentionally aided or counseled or conspired. And it's going to focus on the issues that you were just raising there. Under the ordinary law, and I don't know about Minnesota in this case, but I'd be surprised if it were any different. It would also be possible to charge them with murder based on, as you were describing it, their failure to act, their failure to do anything, because it is possible to convict people of committing crimes, of causing death when they did nothing, if they had a legal obligation to act. And being police officers and being part of that particular team, I would imagine that they did have a legal obligation to protect the prisoner here.
Now, we're talking, Bill Dunlop from Quinnipiac, obviously, about the criminal case, which, of course, has to be a unanimous decision. We all know that. But there will, as in the OJ case and other cases like this, Bill, there could, long after this is done, however long that takes, civil action as well from the family or the estate of George Floyd aimed at what, Bill, the police department, the state of Minnesota, the city? Tell us a little about that.
Well, I think you just named all the potential defendants there. And I'm sure that once this criminal case is over, in fact, even before it's over, I would imagine that the civil lawsuit will be filed. But it probably will not go to trial until the case is ended. And if the case ends in convictions, that's going to make it much easier for the plaintiffs, for the family, to establish civil liability.
And finally, Bill, we're hearing today, and there was rumors of it yesterday, and the Attorney General Bill Barr came out today talking about federal initiatives here. Bill, you know how these things work. There's always this battle of states' rights and federalism versus a federal level. But as I said on my show the other day, you know, when a plane crashes or a boat goes down or a train crashes, you know, there's a federal investigation, but then the NTSB usually comes in here. Bill, do you think in the wake of this, we may ever see more state level or even federal level protections or even a separate area of scrutiny that may, to use a term, you know, may have a Bigfoot here effect on stepping in and taking it away from local jurisdictions even more than federal civil rights legislation does now? Are we on the way to that, you think?
I don't think we're going to be able to take it away from the local jurisdictions. Obviously, the crimes that we're talking about here, the police enforcement we're talking about, is at the heart of the police power, which is the power that's reserved to the states by the federal Constitution. Even before the 10th Amendment, that was the system in the United States. We granted certain powers to the federal government, and the rest, primarily the police power, was reserved to the states. That changed to some extent with the 14th and 15th Amendments, which you seem to be referring to earlier, because now the federal government and specifically Congress has the power to pass laws and carry out investigations relating to violations of equal protection rights and violations of due process. So certainly Congress can get involved here with oversight and with passing laws prohibiting states from violating rights. But I don't think we'll ever get to the point where the federal government actually takes over local law enforcement.
Bill, thank you as always. Bill Dunlap, constitutional law professor and expert from the Quinnipiac University Law School. Bill, thank you. Be good. Undoubtedly, we'll have you back during the crux of this. Bill, thanks. Be good.
Thanks. Great talking with you.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you. Well, there you go, folks. Our guy from Quinnipiac, constitutional law professor Bill Dunlap. So, as you heard from Bill, as you heard from our civil rights attorney the other day in New York, Richard Bell, and even now a lot of bloggers are saying, this is not a slam dunk. It appears that he will go to jail, at least Officer Chauvin, for something. But, again, you have to, in a criminal case, not a civil case. Remember, civil case is 12-member jury. That's a simple majority, 7-5, for civil damages. But for a criminal case, a state or a federal government against a person versus a civil case, which is two parties going at each other, the estate or family of George Floyd and the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul, the state of Minnesota. That's a simple majority. But you need unanimity. You need a unanimous vote or votes on criminal charges. Back here on Connecticut Today on WICC 600 on your radio and online at WICC600.com. It's a case that everybody still talks about. And after he was found dead in prison, everybody kind of looking at each other going, yep, told you so. Of course, we talk about Jeffrey Epstein, new book out, A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein, written by Alana Goodman and Daniel Halper. We're joined today on WICC by co-author Alana Goodman. Alana, hi. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. What made you dive into this with your co-author, this Jeffrey Epstein case that still people today are talking about?
Yeah, well, this is one of the biggest crime stories in America, and we felt that there were so many unanswered questions. How could this have happened while he was in federal custody? As you said, I mean, people were predicting this before it even happened. How did he get away with this? With his crimes for so long? What was his relationship with powerful political figures? So we wanted to move the ball forward as much as we could in terms of answering those questions.
I think you mentioned a couple of seconds ago quite properly, Jeffrey Epstein was not in some country jail. He was not even in a local jail. He was in a federal lockup.
Yeah, well, as we looked into this, we found that we don't think that foul play could be dismissed outright. We talked to prison guards who worked at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, which was where Epstein died, and they said that it would have been extremely difficult for him to kill himself in this way without some sort of outside help. We also talked to Epstein's lawyer, David Schoen, who described how he was enthusiastically plotting his legal defense strategies in the hours before he died. And we talked to Epstein's brother as well, who said that he has been stonewalled by authorities in trying to find out basic information about what happened. He also was able to get a picture of the noose that Epstein allegedly used to hang himself. And Epstein, one of the guards, prison guards had said that he cut Epstein down from this noose. Now, in this photograph, the noose appears to be hemmed on all edges with no cut marks. Jeffrey Epstein's brother, says that he wants to know more about this and why there are no cut marks on that noose. But he has had a difficult time getting answers from authorities.
Who is in possession, Alana, of the physical evidence in this case? Who has it?
Well, this would be the New York Medical Examiner's Office and the Department of Justice. And so at this point, I think we need to see more transparency from them. It would be great to have interviews that the FBI conducted with the guards and other prison officials, full medical records, including records from Epstein's first alleged suicide attempt a few weeks prior to this, which his lawyers have said was not a suicide attempt, and also release any footage as far as it's available from the prison. And I would be very interested in seeing whether there were any interviews done with inmates who were in his cell block by Bureau of Prison officials at the time of his death, because we know from reporting this book that the inmates in his cell block were dispersed immediately after his body was found and placed in other areas. Were these people interviewed at that time by government authorities? And if so, what did they say? What did they see? What did they hear?
Did anybody in the interviews that you conducted, Alana Goodman, or your co-author, Daniel Halper, how many people, if any, said to you and Daniel, this case is not what it looks like? There's no way he killed himself or did it willingly. How many people said that to you?
Well, this can't, multiple people who knew him. I mean, this was David Schoen, who was a lawyer for him and also friends with him for years, said that he does not believe that he committed suicide. He thinks that there was foul play involved. He's a civil rights lawyer, and he was very close with Jeffrey Epstein, and he actually met with him. The last time he met with him was just days before he died. He met with him at the prison, and they were plotting out a legal defense strategy. So, yeah, there was a lot of skepticism from people who were close to Epstein and knew him for a long time, his close friends, who said this just seems not kind of the person who he was. He was very confident in his chances of prevailing in this case. He knew that he had all the money in the world to hire the best lawyers, which he did, and to fight this to the full extent of his abilities. And his legal team was also very confident. They thought that they had a good shot of being victorious in this case. So there were a lot of doubts.
What is the overall thought that you and your co-author picked up here, Alana, as to who wanted him dead? If he was killed or poisoned, or if suicide wasn't somehow, in some way, encouraged, who was behind that?
Well, I don't know if we can say any specific person, but there were certainly a lot of people who were happier with him gone. He knew a lot of information on powerful political figures. He had, he had a powerful network of friends, including Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, Victoria's Secret billionaire Leslie Wexner. And we found that his relationship with Clinton and Trump was closer than both have previously acknowledged. In Clinton's case, for example, we found that Epstein had a direct line to President Clinton going back to when he was in the White House in the 1990s. And in one instance, Clinton was at a party at Carolyn Kennedy's on Martha's Vineyard, and the Secret Service came in and pulled him out to take a phone call with Jeffrey Epstein. And that was in the 1990s while Clinton was still in the White House. So there was a closer relationship here than has been acknowledged.
The name of the book is A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein, Alana Goodman and Daniel Halper, the co-authors. Alana, before we take a break, looking at this case, how powerful was Jeffrey Epstein in a sense of if he had talked? How big of an earthquake would that have been in the political and business worlds? How many people could he have brought down?
Well, what he would like to do is he would try to pull, sensitive or salacious information out of people. He, according to sources that we talked to, his house in New York was wired up with cameras, including the bathroom. And one of the things we were told was that Bill Clinton's primary motive for hanging out around Epstein was that he was having an affair with Ghislaine Maxwell, who was Epstein's on and off girlfriend for many, many years, and who has been accused of helping Epstein procure underage girls. So that certainly could have been something that, Epstein could have leveraged against Clinton in this case. We also found that Epstein and Trump had a close relationship as well. And at one point, Trump organized a party for beauty pageant contestants at Mar-a-Lago and invited Epstein as the featured guest, according to the pageant director. The pageant director was very angry about this, he told us, because he said that he had banned Epstein from his events prior to this, because he said that Epstein had come on to the girls who come on to the beauty pageant contestants, some of whom were as young as 15 years old. We were also told that Trump did eventually cut ties with Epstein when he found out that he tried to solicit the daughter of a Mar-a-Lago member, and this would have been prior to Epstein's first arrest.
We'll have more with Alanna Goodman on the book A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein, after traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Back here on WICC 600, the name of the book is A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein. Alanna Goodman and Daniel Halper are the co-authors. A few more minutes with Alanna Goodman. Alanna, what went on that island that Jeffrey Epstein owned and brought very powerful people to?
Well, according to certain sources, he was bringing underage girls. He was using. He had a major sex trafficking operation, according to all of the evidence that was compiled in his case. And I also want to note, he also tried to create this kind of air of mystery. He wanted to give people this impression that he was maybe involved with foreign intelligence or domestic intelligence. So he would make these statements to friends like, you know, back at Langley, they would say such and such to me, kind of implying that he was involved with the CIA or U.S. intelligence. We did not find any evidence of this, but he certainly had connections with foreign officials as well, including in the U.K., Israel, and Saudi Arabia. And in addition to that, the fact that his home in New York was wired with all of these cameras, it did give impressions to some of his friends that he might have been involved in this kind of shadowy intelligence world. We, again, did not find anything to corroborate that from intelligence sources who I spoke to. Intelligence sources who I talked to said that probably if he was providing information to the government, it was likely more of a one-way street, and they really doubted that he would have been privy to any sort of important national security information given his background and lifestyle during this time. But that is one kind of interesting angle that I know many people have looked into.
Mm-hmm. His alleged madam, Ghislaine Maxwell, she's apparently still out there floating around. I would imagine, Alanna, that she has enough information that could still bring people down, correct? What do you think?
I think that Ghislaine Maxwell absolutely is kind of the key to a lot of these things, and I hope that she does decide to talk at some point. As I said, Epstein's legal team really did think that he had a solid case, and that was based on his, a agreement that he had entered after his first arrest on underage prostitution charges. He had entered a non-prosecution agreement on future similar crimes. And so they really thought that this was kind of a good case for him. And there was an argument that this could have extended to people in his, inner orbit, including Ghislaine Maxwell as well. So as people are watching this and wondering why has she not been prosecuted, I think that might be a reason for it because, his lawyers did think that he had a good case on this, and there might be some hesitance to extradite her if she is in a foreign country to come face a trial.
So finally, and a final question here, Alanna, as we wrap up, between your book and all the stories that have been written about this new Netflix series that's out there right now, despite all the great reporting on this that you and other folks are doing, it seems like the further you dig deep into this, it just grows more questions, doesn't it?
So many questions, yes. And it's such a wide-ranging story. And I think, the real takeaway from this, if Epstein had not died, he would be facing trial. He was scheduled to face trial this month for his crimes of sex trafficking. And I think that it is, he was never able to face justice in this case. And I think that it is important for the government to release information that it has to show why that happened, whether it was, incompetence by guards or what. I think that the public deserves to have more information and more transparency and you know, information on interviews that, like, the full interviews that were conducted with the guards and prison officials, full medical records, the footage from the prison to the extent that it is available, and interviews with inmates who were on his cell block at the time of his death. I think that it's just very important to know why victims of his crimes were not able to see him face justice in trial.
The name of the book, A Convenient Death, A Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein, co-authors Daniel Halper and Alanna Goodman. Alanna, thank you for joining us. Good luck with the book, and we'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
First off, let me show you our COVID daily summary. Couple of things worth noting. We've now surpassed 4,000 folks who have died due to COVID. I remember a few months ago when the Surgeon General came to our state and thought it might be like a bad flu season, which is, say, 150 fatalities. The good news, I guess, if there is anything, is good news. Again, our positivity rate is low. That's 148 tested positive over 5,000 tests. That's less than 3%. It's been less than 3% now for, certainly less than 5% for, I think, a week. So I think you see that we're making progress there. I do worry a little bit that people get casual now. We're having to urge people to get tested. Testing is down a little bit, as you see, and how important that is. And I don't want us to get in casual in general. I see the flare-up in Charlotte. I see the flare-ups in Phoenix, Arizona. I see what's going on around the country, along with South Korea. Israel just had to close down their schools, which is why we are being so careful as we reopen. And we did our announcement yesterday regarding graduations, and we'll be making further announcements tomorrow. Total hospitalizations statewide, I think you still see the trend way down, 75%. Anything else there, Max? I guess not. Let me just say something before we go into our fiscal health. And that's, this is always about trust. I mean, you've got to take the words of our experts and others when we give you the best guidance we can in terms of how to keep the public health and making sure we don't have a flare-up going forward. That's tied directly to what Melissa and our business folks are trying to do. Nobody's going to go back to work. Nobody's going to be buying things unless they have trust and confidence that the advice we're giving them is well taken. It's safe to go back, provided you follow the precautions. And as you've seen from another night of our protests around the state and around the country, that involves trust as well. Trust that this is a society that, despite some gross injustices, is trying every day to do a little bit better. And as you've heard, because we've had some of our folks from public safety here, I've been proud of the efforts our public safety has made working closely with the protesters and what that means in terms of trust. Because if you don't believe the public safety is there for you, and if the protesters don't believe that there's sometimes a shared goal out there, you have some conflicts and dangers, as you've seen all around us, and thank God, not yet here in Connecticut. A part of that trust is, part of that trust is transparency and accountability. And there I'd like to say that Connecticut is got a long way to go, but we're off to a good start. You maybe remember last year we passed a bill with great help from Senator Gary Winfield, New Haven, and Representative Steve Stastrom. That bill sailed through on a bipartisan basis. The state Senate got clicked up a little bit with partisanship in the House, but it was a really important bill. There's a lot of questions and talk out there about use of force, and how is it excessive, and what are the rules of the road, and how can our public safety officials be better? And this bill clearly defined what those rules of the road can be, and tried to narrowly define the use of force in a way that I hope makes our folks safer. It mandates that we categorize the use of force and make sure that we are able to report on that, strictly in terms of chokeholds and other things that we now find reprehensible. It clearly defined that going forward. you know, you'll find that a lot of people are talking about other ways we regulate the use of force. There's been a lot of talk about when you use a firearm, when you can shoot a firearm, for example, at a fleeing car. This bill addressed that, put in place, again, some confidence-building measures that we're listening to you, doing what we can, made requirement there for our body cams. Those are the things that you know, our police have that goes on automatically when the lights go on in the police car, that those ought to be released. Within, I think it was 4 days was the requirement coming out of the bill that our legislature wisely passed. 4 days, why is that? To give you confidence that we have nothing to hide, give you confidence that our public safety officials want to share with you their best efforts. I've gotten to be pretty good friends with our detail and the state police, and I said, you find this intrusive? Do you find this the heavy hand with the mandating the body cams? And they said, not at all. We think we've been doing the right thing, and now I want a body cam that shows that we were doing the right thing. The exact opposite happened in Minnesota. I just also say, included in that bill that passed last year was a public police accountability and transparency task force. They met a few times, got COVID interrupted, and together with the legislature, we're going to work to make sure this gets rejuvenated now. It includes the district attorney, it includes commissioner of public safety, it includes state police, and it includes community activists. And next meeting is scheduled for early next week. I hope they invite me to attend, at least electronically. I'd like to be there. I know the Attorney General, William Tong, would like to participate as well. Just to make sure we know this is just the first step as we listen and try and do a better job of building trust between our public safety and, in this case, the protesters, more broadly, the community and public that they represent. I'll just leave you with the thought that we're one of 12 states in the country where police disciplinary records are generally accessible. We were the first state to collect traffic stop data. That was back in 2013, way before my time. Now it's a model for California, Oregon, Rhode Island, and other places. It was that same year that we made it illegal for our police departments to hire officers who were, quote, dismissed for serious misconduct or resigned while under investigation. It looks self-explanatory today, but we were there. We're just getting started, trying to earn your trust when it comes to public safety, because that's how we all stay safer. And with that, let me just say, Melissa McCaw has been doing yeoman's work when it comes to our fiscal health. And as I said before, our fiscal health and the numbers she'll talk through are really key to trust again, because if people don't feel safe going back into a business, if employees don't feel safe that they can go back to the business, if they don't know we have a 211 hotline, so if you find something is awry, give us a call. We're going to do everything we can to keep you safe. Then the consumer, then the customer, then the employee is going to be reluctant to get back to work. And for our fiscal health here as a state, it's very important that we can see our economy slowly getting back to work. Melissa will describe, you know, the numbers as we look at sales tax and income tax, and we count on it ramping back up by the end of this calendar year. You know, you've heard big numbers coming out of Washington, D.C., you know, the Paycheck Protection Program. You know, that was $6.8 billion to the state of Connecticut alone. That provides money for small business to bridge their need until we can get this economy going again. It runs out end of June, end of July, depending on when you got that loan. That's why getting the confidence to rebuild our economy is so important. You know, unemployment compensation, we've put to work, I think it's, you know, billions of dollars right now, a couple billion dollars out there. The true-up goes till July 31st, so that does not go forever. Now's the time for us to be thinking about how we get back to work. But what Melissa would like to talk to you about is the, you know, COVID relief money we got as the state of Connecticut. It's about $1.4 billion. It goes to pay for a lot of COVID-related expenses. It doesn't help us with the fact that our income tax and sales tax took a big hit over the last 3 months, and it's estimated to take a hit over the next 6 months. But it helps in terms of those COVID expenses. I'm just going to outline what it means for different constituencies, stakeholders here for the state, and in particular for our municipalities. Melissa?
Great. Thank you very much, Governor Lamont, and thank you for teeing that up. Today, I will just remind us about the state's fiscal health, and Connecticut's position at the current time is very strong. We entered this particular unprecedented public health emergency from a position of strength with a greater than $2.5 billion rainy day fund, one of the highest in the nation and the largest that Connecticut has ever had. So from a cash position, and what does that mean? Making sure you have money in the bank to pay the bills, we're in a strong position. We will close the current fiscal year with a $600 million shortfall, and we will have to tap our rainy day fund. And as we go into next year, we do face a $2.4 billion deficit on a $20 billion budget. And we will have to use multiple tools between our rainy day fund and some cutting back, if you will. But we will survive that, and our focus today and the focus of the governor is ensuring that Connecticut is able to emerge from this public health crisis and begin to reopen our economy in a safe way that creates confidence. And that will ultimately have an effect on the state's finances as people are reemployed, businesses begin to rebound. We'll see the benefit of that in our tax revenue. But today I really want to focus in on the extensive financial support that we have received from the federal government that, quite frankly, if we did not have, would have made it very difficult for Connecticut in responding to the public health emergency. So as noted, the $1.4 billion is just one of the resources that has been received from the federal government to help Connecticut cover the cost that we are experiencing related to the pandemic. And so these funds are subsidized along with other programs. We have a FEMA program that provides support. But we really wanted to focus today on our municipalities. Our municipalities, your town, my town, is also feeling the impact of additional coronavirus expenses, whether it's to stand up additional food programs for seniors or to sanitize buildings or additional overtime that they might be experiencing in the public health department or their public safety department. And so the governor was very focused on ensuring that we are able to provide financial support. And today we are announcing a $75 million municipal coronavirus relief fund. Beginning in April, we reached out to all of our municipalities to inquire about estimated costs through June 30th, 2020. And we completed that process on May 29th. Our towns and cities told us that through the end of the current fiscal year, through June 30th, that they estimate that they will incur $40 million of direct costs. And so we are standing up $75 million in support. We have recently learned that the federal government will allow us to match the FEMA reimbursement with coronavirus relief funds. So FEMA cost, whether it's shelter-related expenses, PPE-related cost, other supplies, the federal government will reimburse at 75%. This new program that the governor has authorized, the Municipal Coronavirus Relief Fund, will be able to match those dollars at 25%. And so between the FEMA, along with the Coronavirus Relief Fund and any other federal funding dollars, we believe that municipalities will be fully funded for their expenses through June 30th, and we will then begin to evaluate the program for expenses beyond that time period. Just to be very clear, to use these funds, they have to be direct COVID-related expenses. They do not cover any lost government revenue, cannot be for funds that you previously had budgeted, and the bottom line is it has to be for expenses during the public health emergency between March 1st and December 30th. You should know that there are a number of funding sources to support towns. So in addition to the program the governor's rolling out and FEMA, $111 million was released to all of our boards of ed through Commissioner Cardona's office, the State Department of Education, to support remote learning costs for all of our children in pre-K through 12. So those additional expenses that your schools incurred to ensure that our children were learning from home. So that will help to support what expenses have been incurred, and also as we begin to think about what the fall might look like, along with public health costs for your local health districts and other grants. So one of the conditions of participating in this program is that municipalities would first use other federal funding sources first, and then they would seek reimbursement through the governor's grant program. Other things that I would highlight is that towns will be required to submit for reimbursement or an approval of what could be reimbursed through FEMA first, and then anything that is remaining that is eligible through the Coronavirus Relief Fund can be reimbursed from the $40 million that the governor is making available. In order to do this, this process, thought it was very important that towns have an electronic process to submit their claims, and so we have created a portal, and so municipalities will have an opportunity to participate in webinars and go through the process of how they would actually submit for reimbursement. Some examples of the types of expenses that towns are incurring: cleaning costs, disinfecting public buildings. Perhaps towns have had to incur additional IT-related expenses for teleworking, school distance learning, additional overtime costs, shelter costs for our vulnerable population that might have needed some housing. And in many cases, we had to take them out of congregate settings and put them into smaller settings to prevent the spread of the virus. And so $75 million is being provided to municipalities out of the $1.4 billion. We do believe that the $75 million coupled with FEMA reimbursement, which could leverage another $100 to $200 million for municipalities, will allow us to support all of our cities and towns through the majority of the rest of this calendar year. And so I know there have been a lot of questions about how the state will utilize the $1.4 billion that has been provided. And so we want to make sure that we're providing transparency. So I want to highlight some of the other decisions that the governor and the administration have made with respect to COVID response. And so in addition to the $75 million for municipalities, we have provided a reserve funding of approximately $125 million for our nursing homes. Our nursing homes are experiencing increased costs to support workers, whether they have to incentivize or cover additional overtime, additional PPE, other supplies, and therefore we've put in place a financial package to support nursing homes. We also are reserving $250 million for testing. This is a critical component of the state's COVID response, and also building confidence that we can return to some level of the new norm. And so you will recall this week that nursing home staff and residents, as well as assisted living staff and residents, are now required to have testing at specific frequency intervals. We have set aside funding to help support some of those costs, and COO Josh Jabal is on the line, and the team is continuing to build out what that testing plan will look like. And so that is evolving. The state has reserved $100 million for PPE, which will also be matched by FEMA. Within our state agencies, we've incurred a significant amount of expenses. Approximately $65 million is estimated to cover the sanitation of our buildings, to stand up the mobile hospital that we needed to have in place in the event of a significant surge, to cover overtime costs for the staff that provide direct care. And so $65 million has been reserved for those types of expenses. Even our institutions of higher education, they've incurred similar costs. We're providing support of $25 million to offset the expenses that they've experienced. And finally, you heard the governor talk a little bit about the housing support program. We are reserving $10 million for housing supports for renter relief. You are aware that through executive order that individuals have some protection for a short time frame from eviction, but we all understand if you're not receiving your standard paycheck and you're receiving less than, or you're experiencing have some financial challenges, that when that period expires, individuals could be facing eviction. So the governor's felt it's very important to provide some supports to help individuals through that time period. So I say that to, one, make sure that you're aware that your state is ensuring that COVID-related expenses that are critical to our response and to ensuring that we can reopen safely, that those commitments are being made to date of about $650 million. And as we continue to work on reopening and understand the best practices We will continue to roll out additional funding, many of items of which are under consideration at this time, and we'll continue to update you accordingly. So that's a summary for today, and we will be communicating on our website with municipalities as well as directly how they can access the support program to help your towns with the additional costs that you've incurred.
Well, you just did this for the Democratic leadership. You just did this for the Republican leadership. You've got the presentation down. Thanks, Melissa. Any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, in light of what we know about schools reopening, we just got this information from the teachers union where 43% say that they're at high risk and 64% say that their schools are really not equipped for sanitary measures. So how is that going to have an impact on successfully reopening schools in the fall?
I mentioned trust at the top of this, and we're working very closely. Jan Hockadel, as you know, was on our reopening committee, working closely with Jeff and Don and everybody else representing the teachers, making sure they are part of the process as we slowly plan on our reopening of our schools this fall. We also have to talk to parents and give them confidence that we're doing this in an appropriate way. There'll be a social distancing, there'll be spacing between desks, there'll be sanitation standards, there'll be masks. That's all from a public health protocol and also a confidence builder.
But I mean, if the teachers really, or nearly half of them, don't really feel comfortable coming back, I mean, what type of impact could that have on the school year?
It doesn't sound that good to me. So that's why we continue to give people the best sense I can, working with the very best healthcare professionals, that we can open the schools and open them on a way that keeps you safe and your kids safe.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. Quick question for you about the Restaurant Association. More than 550 restaurants signed on to a letter to you asking you to consider opening indoor dining on Wednesday, June 10th. Is that something that you would reconsider, and what's your response to them?
No, not June 10th. I've just seen tens of thousands of people protesting in New York City, thousands more in Boston. Neither of them have opened up any of their restaurants. They haven't even opened for outdoor dining that I know of as yet. So I want to be very careful before we open our restaurants and invite people from the whole region here. But I think we'll be getting there, you know, as part of our phase two plan.
And when do you expect to release more details and guidelines about what it will look like for gyms when they reopen on June 20th? Do you expect that people working out will be having to wear masks while they exercise?
Yeah, I think we are planning to release all those protocols, including gyms and indoor dining and all those specifics on Monday.
Perfect. Thank you, Governor.
Move along next to News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, I hope I'm not jumping the gun on this, but I did have a question regarding the mortgage relief program, if that's okay. With respect to, obviously, there's so much good that has come out of that, and really the announcement about the extension certainly buys people a lot of time. Nothing is forever, though. Have some of the participating banks and so forth expressed to you that, you know, there is a point where we're not going to be able to do an extension? In other words, if need be, will you be able to go beyond July 30th?
I hope not. I mean, I hope the economy is getting going and people are slowly getting back to work. As you heard, the PPP, a lot of the other protections that have been put into place run up until June 30th or July 31st. The $600 true-up on unemployment ends then. And I don't have any idea what the federal government is going to be doing for the next round. So that's why I want to cautiously but thoroughly get our economy moving again.
Is with us, Republican State Senator Fairfield. Tony, how are you today, sir?
I'm good, Paul. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, thanks, Tony. And this has been something I've been harping on the show for months. And it's not only happening here. The number was 81% of the deaths in Minnesota were nursing home deaths. It's 70 or 72% here. So, Tony, what is happening tonight? You're with several people, state folks who are intimately connected with the elderly population. What is going on with you folks tonight in looking at how our nursing homes are in the COVID-19 thing and the state of the care right now?
Well, it is a devastating number, and we have nearly 2,700 deaths from nursing homes and assisted living facilities in the state of Connecticut, virtually making up nearly 75% of all the corona-related deaths in the state of Connecticut. And it's remarkable because these are data and casualties that has been long due and coming, Paul. This is actually the first report of these data. You know, we get updated data for COVID infections and deaths every single day from the governor, and we get that ad nauseum. But what's startling is, Paul, the May 20th report was the first report of nursing homes and assisted living facility COVID-impacted infections and deaths. It's remarkable. Why did it take so long to get the data to assess and address this issue? And I did some homework on it, and one of the reasons is the state of Connecticut doesn't regulate assisted living facilities. It regulates the agencies that provide the medical services to the resident, mm-hmm. and there was a tremendous lack of coordination between the facilities that had to independently report, the medical examiner's office, and the Department of Public Health. So the data that we have been used to drive containment, addressing the issue, were never available. And that was one of the biggest startling data. And to the point that we haven't gotten an update since that mid-May report, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Tony, hang on. I'll be right back with you because we're talking about the nursing home situation. Tony, be right back with you. Traffic and weather together on the 6s here, 536 on WICC. And joining us right now, frequent guest here on the radio station, Tony Wong, Republican State Senate member from Fairfield. Tony's going to be holding a Facebook event tonight with other officials from around the state, AARP and all that, the Southwestern Council on Aging, taking a look at the staggering numbers that we see in nursing homes. We're seeing these all over the country, but in Connecticut now, it's risen steadily to over 70% of the COVID-19 deaths here in the state are in nursing homes. And, you know, Tony, above and beyond the nursing homes here, and please, you know, I'm not trying to sugarcoat this at all. I had a mother and father who lived their last years in facilities like this, an aunt and an uncle I took both care of. The problem, Tony, I also see with these numbers not being upfront as they should be or as best they should be, is it destroys an overall different view that we have on COVID-19. I can't tell you the number of people, Tony, that just in conversation and one-on-one or on Facebook when I say, by the way, you know these now over 4,000 deaths we have in the state. I say to them, you know that over 70% of these are in nursing homes and of the quote-unquote general population, it's less than 3 in 10. Tony, they don't know. They have no idea.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a devastating number, isn't it, Paul? And you talk about, obviously, the rationale that these are people that are ill and need support and care and very high risk and vulnerable. That is all true. But the fact that we didn't have data points, the fact that we weren't able to really get ahead of it early and really address it, even right now we're not fully addressing it, and that was reason why we wanted to do this forum, was one, to address how we can do a better job. And I know the governor has really tried with the announcement, I think it's 7UU of his executive order, to now test every worker on a weekly basis, quote-unquote, later on into this month of June. But the fact is, it really is containment rather than getting ahead of it. I think the other critical issue, Paul, that doesn't get talked about beyond the numbers and the devastating sadness of it is you're talking about the emotional tolls of families and loved ones that are separated from their loved ones. You know, what's frustrating is the Department of Public Health made an announcement through the governor's executive order that in March that they were going to close off access to loved ones visiting family and loved ones in nursing homes until mid-September. You can't see loved ones that are vulnerable and at risk, that are your loved ones, until mid-September without any clarification or input from shareholders. That's another punch to the stomach for people that are struggling with their loved ones in vulnerable positions.
Tony, I see that you extended an invitation to the interim commissioner of the health department, Deidre Gifford, who took over when our previous commissioner was let go by the governor a few weeks ago. Is Commissioner Gifford going to participate or not?
Well, as of 5:45, no, but we were waiting to get a statement to allow the interim commissioner, who has now taken on an immense role of revamping and updating the communications and interactions with the various nursing homes and assisted living facilities, to get everybody on the same path, working together and getting answers. I'm hopeful that she'll be able to issue a statement so that we can have the administration and the Department of Public Health give a viewpoint and direction. But I'm also pleased by the incredible talent of people that have given their time. You know, Senator Kevin Kelly, who is the ranking member of Aging and the Real Estate Insurance Committee that handles aspects of health care and insurance and coverage, he's going to offer his incredible talent and expertise in that area. Nora Duncan from the AARP agencies, which is spearheading some of the advocacy points and difficult questions that needed to be asked that they've been on a point of. And we got Marie Allen, who is the Southwestern Connecticut Area Agency on Aging. They provide tremendous resources for our senior population, from social work to transportation to critical services that people need but don't really know how to get to. And then we have Penny Young, who was on the Aging Commission, started and founded Waveney in New Canaan, and herself being a caretaker for a loved one. I wanted to have somebody that is at that stage in their lives and have lived through and know peers that are going through these experiences and has a caregiver to bring those kind of perspectives so we as policymakers can understand how we can support and help those residents that are going through a difficult transition at a different stage in their lives.
Okay, Tony, this is coming up tonight, 7 p.m. They can go to your Facebook page and click on there and find the Facebook Live, correct?
Absolutely. Senator Huang on Facebook, we'll do a live. We'll have it recorded. We'll put it onto our website. But I think the key is really having that conversation, Paul. But it's really incredible. You have been a champion in addressing this issue when people, no one wanted to talk about it. But these numbers are startling. You can't look the other way
and
anymore.
Tony, I would hope that you guys and gals from both sides of the aisle, if and when you get to that session that still has to happen because of the budget issues, you know, I would hope that at least in short order, maybe anticipating a second wave here, that more structured protocols and even maybe some quick legislation can be put in place to protect against this, hopefully, from happening again.
Well, I'll offer this. Senator Kelly, who I respect and learn a lot from, has said this even before the pandemic, Paul, that our aging healthcare structure and service delivery for our elderly population is insufficient. The system and the infrastructure is insufficient. And what this pandemic showed was it totally collapsed the system. The other thing I want to give kudos out is the tremendous clinical workers and support staff workers that are working at those assisted facilities and nursing homes. They are on the front line as well. They don't always get the recognition, but it really is something that we need to address. And unfortunately, with these startling numbers, you can't look any other way. And the emotional toll on the residents and their loved ones who care deeply about them simply needs to be addressed.
Tony, thank you. Take care. We'll be in touch. Be good.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thanks. All right.